Hello and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a featured original research article by Slater et al. Long-term survival of children discharged from pediatric intensive care, a linked data cohort study. Objectives: the long-term survival of children discharged from PICUs and factors associated with mortality following discharge have not been systematically studied. The objective was to describe the long-term survival of children discharged alive from Australian PICUs and identify factors associated with death after discharge. Design: a cohort data linkage study. Setting: the Australian and New Zealand Pediatric Intensive Care Registry linked with the Australian National Death Index. Patients: children discharged from PICUs in Australia between 1997 and 2018. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Exposures included the time period of admission, demographic, social, and admission factors. A multivariable Cox proportional hazards model and Kaplan-Meier survival curves were used to investigate exposures associated with mortality. The records of 96,743 children were available for analysis. The risk of death reduced over time. Compared with children admitted from 1997 to 2002, the hazard ratios for death after discharge for children in other years were as follows. The hazard ratio from 2003 to 2008 was 0.92, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.85 to 0.99. The hazard ratio from 2009 to 2013 was 0.69, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.64 to 0.745. And the hazard ratio for 2014 to 2018 was 0.6, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.55 to 0.65. The risk of death associated with low-risk underlying conditions, such as asthma, was 70% lower than the reference or standard risk group, while there was a sevenfold increase in the risk of death with very high-risk underlying conditions, such as malignancy. Residing in outer regional and very remote areas was associated with higher risk of death. Conclusions: the survival of children discharged from Australian PICUs has improved over time. The risk of death reduced by 40% over the study period. The underlying disease, age, and residing in locations with reduced access to healthcare were associated with reduced probability of survival after discharge. Abstract 2 is a featured original research article by Middleton et al. Post-sepsis care needs in children and families, single-center, co-design qualitative research from Western Australia. Objectives: sepsis for children and their parents is a life-altering illness with far-reaching psychosocial and physical impacts. We aim to explore the needs of such patients and their parents after hospital admission for sepsis to inform the development of a Western Australian post-sepsis care service. Design: qualitative study co-designed with four parents of children with personal experience of sepsis, which involved audio recording of interviews and focus groups of parents and healthcare and education professionals. Setting: Perth Children's Hospital, Western Australia. Patients and participants: over a two-month period in 2024, 15 parents of children who had recovered from sepsis were interviewed. Four parents participated in a focus group. There were also 23 healthcare or education professionals who participated in two focus groups. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: the audio-recorded focus groups were transcribed verbatim, anonymized, and analyzed using inductive descriptive thematic analysis. Across both groups of participants, two major themes and six sub-themes were identified. The major themes were the impact of sepsis and supportive care after sepsis. The impact of sepsis varied between individuals with the potential to affect multiple aspects of family life. Parents highlighted the profound psychosocial and physical consequences of sepsis, emphasizing the need for individualized support, communication, and follow-up after discharge. Professionals outlined gaps in current post-sepsis care practices and suggested additional support measures for children and their families. Care coordination, described as a holistic, cross-sector healthcare model, was identified as a key need to ensure seamless collaboration across health, education, disability, and community sectors, while providing families with education, information, and resources. Conclusions: this follow-up study of parents and healthcare or education professionals identified that in post-sepsis care, there is a need for coordinated, individualized follow-up with ongoing clinical support for families after discharge. Abstract 3 is a featured original research article by Winter et al. Death 1 hour after terminal extubation in children, validation of a machine learning model to predict cardiac death after withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment in a multi-center cohort from 2009 to 2021. Objectives. In the PICU, predicting death within 1 hour after terminal extubation is valuable in augmenting family counseling and in identifying suitable candidates for organ donation after circulatory determination of death, or DCDD. The objective of this study was to train and validate a machine learning model to predict death within 1 hour after terminal extubation. Design. The Death 1 Hour After Terminal Extubation, or DONATE, database was generated using multi-center retrospective data from 2009 to 2021. Data covering demographics, clinical features, vital signs, laboratory values, ventilator settings, medications, and procedures were collected. Machine learning models were trained to predict whether a pediatric patient would die within 1 hour after terminal extubation and evaluated on a holdout set. Setting, 10 U.S. PICUs. Patients, children and adolescents 0 to 21 years old who died after terminal extubation, N equal to 957. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The final model was a parsimonious extra trees model with 21 input features. It was trained on the 2009 to 2018 data from 8 sites with an N equal to 634 and evaluated on a holdout set comprised of the 2019 to 2021 data of all 10 sites with an N equal to 323, representing temporal and external validation. The area under the receiver operating characteristic curve and 95% confidence interval was 0.85, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.81 to 0.87. At a sensitivity of 90%, the positive predictive value was 88%, the negative predictive value was 70%, and the number needed to alert was 1.14. Among potential organ donors at the same sensitivity level, the positive predictive value was 86%, the negative predictive value was 74%, and the number needed to alert was 1.17. Conclusions. Our model, trained and validated on multi-site data, predicted whether a child will die within 1 hour of terminal extubation with high discrimination and a low false alarm rate. This finding has important applications to end-of-life counseling and institutional resource utilization when families wish to attempt DCDD. Abstract 4 is a clinical investigation article by St. Louis et al. Infant Organ Donation After Death by Circulatory Criteria, a Literature Scoping Review. Objectives. Infant organ donation is rare, but when it does occur, infants are more commonly eligible for donation after circulatory death, or DCD, than donation after neurological death. The aims of this scoping review were to identify 1. Existing research, ethical, and policy information about infant organ DCD, and 2. Knowledge gaps to guide further research. Data sources. A literature search of Medline, Embase, CINAHL, Scopus, and the Web of Science up to 2024. No other date or search limits were applied. A gray literature search for policy and clinical guideline documents was also conducted. Study selection. 2 reviewers independently screened titles and abstracts, then article full texts. The search yielded 8,176 unique publications, of which 33 were included in this review. The gray literature search yielded 6 relevant documents. Data extraction. Data were extracted by 1 reviewer according to the type of article. For example, donor audit, time to death studies, transplant outcome studies, ethical commentary, position or policy statements. Data synthesis. The article narratives fell into 6 topics, including 1. Donor audits and criteria, 2. Donor care and referral practices, 3. Predictors of time to death, 4. Transplant outcomes, 5. Ethical issues, and 6. Strategies to increase infant organ donation. Donor audits suggest that infant donors are under-recognized despite good transplantation outcomes in transplant reports. While some predictors of time to death were identified, further research is needed. Several ethical issues were highlighted, including debate about permanence versus irreversibility of death as a requirement for DCD. Families of all potentially eligible infants should be offered the option for donation as part of routine care, with high-quality end-of-life care provided regardless of whether donation occurs. Conclusions. Infant DCD remains an uncommon practice worldwide. Ongoing research is crucial to furthering the field of infant DCD and increasing the number of available organs. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation article by Hay et al. Child and Family Outcomes After PICU Admission, Creation of an Open Access Literature Database Using a Global Team of PICU Specialists Integrated with Machine Learning. Objectives: as research examining child health outcomes after PICU admission grows, so does the need for the identification and synthesis of a large body of literature. We aim to create an open access scoping repository of literature describing longer-term health outcomes after PICU admission using a large multinational team, crowdsourcing, and a machine learning algorithm. Data sources: we performed a registered scoping review using Medline, Embase, CIN, AHL, and Central databases from 2000 to 2022 with no language restrictions. Study selection: observational or interventional studies describing outcomes of children 0 to 17 years old and their families or caregivers measured greater than 2 weeks post-PICU discharge. Titles and abstracts and full texts were initially screened by a large team of PICU healthcare workers and researchers who were recruited as part of an evidence hackathon event at the 2022 World Federation of Pediatric Intensive and Critical Care Societies Conference. Initial screening results from 5,000 citations were used to develop and validate a machine learning algorithm, after which a hybrid human crowdsourcing and machine learning approach was used to screen the remaining 11,055 studies. Data synthesis: of 16,055 eligible citations, 1,301 met the criteria at full text for inclusion in the database. The screening was completed in just under 2 months while adhering to the gold standard systematic review methodology. Sensitivity for the hybrid human crowdsourcing and machine learning was 98%. Conclusions: a collaborative global PICU team integrated with machine learning was successful in efficient and accurate large data synthesis, producing a scoping open access database of studies reporting on post-PICU outcomes. The development of this repository has implications for future reviews, providing opportunities for networking and collaborative engagement in research. The next steps should examine database maintenance, utilization, and dissemination of research findings. Abstract 6 is an original research article by Hernandez et al. Hyperprocalcitonemia and Endothelial and Microcirculatory Dysfunction in Children with Sepsis and Septic Shock, Single Center Observational Cohort Study in Colombia from 2021 to 2024. Objectives: to evaluate the association between hyperprocalcitonemia and endothelial and microcirculatory dysfunction in children with sepsis and septic shock and clinical outcomes. Design: a prospective observational cohort study from 2021 to 2024. Setting: a tertiary PICU with 15 medical surgical beds in a university hospital. Patients: we included children with sepsis and/or septic shock who had serum procalcitonin measured at admission, 24 hours, and 48 hours simultaneously with microcirculatory assessment using sublingual video microscopy and biomarkers of endothelial injury, including syndikin 1, angiopoietin 2, and endokin. Hyperprocalcitonemia was defined as procalcitonin greater than 2 nanograms per milliliter. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: in 230 patients, 43.9% or 101 of 230 had hyperprocalcitonemia at PICU admission. After adjusting for confounders, children with hyperprocalcitonemia, compared with those with normal procalcitonin, had higher adjusted odds ratio of reduced capillary blood flow at 24 hours and 48 hours after admission. Adjusted odds ratio at 24 hours was 1.35 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.08 to 1.72, and adjusted odds ratio at 48 hours was 1.14 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.04 to 1.24. At 24 hours, children with hyperprocalcitonemia compared with those without hyperprocalcitonemia had higher median syndikin 1 levels and greater odds of angiopoietin 2 elevation. In those with hyperprocalcitonemia, median syndikin 1 levels were 125.87 nanograms per milliliter with an interquartile range of 49.56 to 224.3 nanograms per milliliter. Those without hyperprocalcitonemia had median syndikin 1 levels of 107.71 nanograms per milliliter with an interquartile range of 62.82 to 156.55 nanograms per milliliter. The p-value was less than 0.01. The adjusted odds ratio for angiopoietin 2 elevation was 2.28 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.08 to 5.17 and a p-value equal to 0.042. hyperprocalcitonemia with severe endothelial and or microcirculatory dysfunction was associated with fluid overload greater than 10%, multiple organ dysfunction, and mortality. The adjusted odds ratio for fluid overload greater than 10% was 2.01 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.06 to 3.8 and a p-value equal to 0.033. The adjusted odds ratio for multiple organ dysfunction was 1.87 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.01 to 3.57 and a p-value equal to 0.041. Lastly, the adjusted odds ratio for mortality was 1.66 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.06 to 2.61 and a p-value equal to 0.022. We failed to identify differences in capillary density, angiopoietin 2, or endokin between children with and without hyperprocalcitonemia at PICU admission. Conclusions. Children with sepsis and septic shock with hyperprocalcitonemia represent a phenotype characterized by endothelial and microvascular dysfunction, which is associated with worse clinical outcomes. Our study suggests that preserving microvascular integrity may be a therapeutic target to reduce microcirculatory damage and improve outcomes. Abstract 7 is a clinical investigation article by Au et al. Hyperlactatemia in critically ill children, modeling early recovery kinetics after initiation of extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Objectives: blood lactate concentration reflects the balance among production, clearance, and volume of distribution. We have observed dramatic improvement in blood lactate concentration in critically ill patients after starting support with extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, and discontinuing vasopressors. Here, we evaluated such lactate concentration profiles to develop a mathematical model of recovery kinetics. We then examined the interrelationships between maximum blood lactate concentration and model-derived parameters of lactate production, endogenous lactate transfer, and clearance of lactate. Design. Mathematical modeling using a convenience sample. Setting: Quaternary U.S. Academic Children's Hospital. Participants: a retrospective sample of 25 ECMO patients from birth to less than 18 years old with serial blood lactate concentration measurements during the first 30 hours after initiation of ECMO. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The median age of patients was 17 days with an interquartile range of 3 to 152 days, and the median weight was 3.3 kilograms with an interquartile range of 2.7 to 4.7 kilograms. At the initiation of ECMO, the mean peak blood lactate concentration was 16.7 millimoles per liter with a 95% confidence interval of 14.3 to 20 millimoles per liter. Recovery in blood lactate concentration could be described using a one-compartment biexponential open model of kinetics. Solving the model equation showed starting lactate load was 17.7 millimoles per kilogram with a 95% confidence interval of 14.6 to 20.7 millimoles per kilogram, and clearance of lactate was 19.7 milliliters per minute with a 95% confidence interval of 3 to 36.4 milliliters per minute. The interrelationship between maximum blood lactate concentration and model-derived parameters in children requiring ECMO at the limits of cardiopulmonary survival showed the following. 1. Lactate production ranged from 2.3 to 6.4 micromoles per kilogram per minute. 2. Initial endogenous lactate transfer velocity was 82.5 to 1,301 micromoles per kilogram per minute. 3. Initial high blood lactate concentration levels suggested severely impaired clearance of lactate. 4. A strong correlation was observed between model-derived velocity and transfer parameters, with a rho of 0.75 and a p-value less than 0.0001 at levels exceeding those seen in high-intensity endurance exercise. And 5. Upon achieving steady state, lactate production and clearance of lactate were balanced. Conclusions. At the time of maximal cardiopulmonary instability requiring ECMO initiation, our model of blood lactate concentration recovery indicated that high initial blood lactate concentration reflected severely impaired and reduced clearance of lactate. This modeling approach may also be applicable to assessing changes in lactate kinetics in other forms of critical illness. Abstract 8 is a clinical investigation article by Lee et al. Pneumonia requiring respiratory support in the PICU, single-center study of admission plasma nucleosome, histone, and citrullinated histone H3 levels in relation to complications. Objectives: to investigate plasma nucleosome, histone H3, and citrullinated histone H3 levels in PICU patients with viral or bacterial pneumonia and the associations with pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome or pediatric ARDS and sepsis. design, single-center observational study of plasma nucleosome, histone H3 or H3, and citrullinated histone H3 levels collected within 24 hours of PICU admission in patients with pneumonia requiring respiratory support. Setting, a children's hospital PICU in Yunnan, China. Patients, pneumonia patients and healthy controls seen during 2022 to 2024. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. A total of 152 children, 0.3 to 12 years old, with severe pneumonia were enrolled, and post hoc, 47 met the 2024 Phoenix criteria for sepsis, and 45 met the 2023 criteria for pediatric ARDS. Pneumonia in comparison with 22 controls was associated with higher levels of all three markers. The nucleosome p-value was equal to 0.0006, the histone H3 p-value was equal to 0.003, and the citrullinated histone H3 p-value was equal to 0.029. In comparison with non-sepsis and non-pediatric ARDS cases, the sepsis and pediatric ARDS categories were associated with higher levels of all three markers. For sepsis, the p-value for nucleosome was less than 0.0001, the p-value for histone H3 was equal to 0.015, and the p-value for citrullinated histone H3 was less than 0.0001. For pediatric ARDS, the p-value for nucleosome was equal to 0.003, the p-value for histone H3 was less than 0.0001, and the p-value for citrullinated histone H3 was equal to 0.0002. The area under the receiver operating characteristic curve analysis with nucleosome level using the sepsis endpoint was 0.79 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.71 to 0.87 and a p-value less than 0.0001. The relationship between histone H3 and pediatric ARDS versus non-ARDS patients was area under the receiver operating characteristic curve of 0.83 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.75 to 0.91 and a p-value less than 0.0001. And there was a negative correlation with PaO2 to FiO2 of R-0.63 and a p-value less than 0.0001. Regarding the association between bacterial versus viral etiology of pneumonia, the combination of plasma citrullinated histone H3 and C-reactive protein showed an area under the receiver operating characteristic curve of 0.84 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.76 to 0.92 and a p-value less than 0.0001. Conclusions. In PICU patients with pneumonia requiring respiratory support, we detected significant plasma levels of nucleosome, histone H3, and citrullinated histone H3 within the first 24 hours of admission. Furthermore, categorization as pediatric ARDS or sepsis was associated with higher levels of these biomarkers. Abstract 9 is a PCCM conference report and expert panel by Lyons et al. Pediatric Palliative Care Subcompetencies for Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Fellowship Trainees. Objectives. Integration of pediatric palliative care and pediatric critical care medicine is essential in providing high-quality patient care. To date, no standardized or recommended framework for educating pediatric critical care medicine fellowship trainees in palliative care exists. We aim to develop pediatric palliative care subcompetencies for pediatric critical care medicine fellows within the constructs of the established Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, or ACGME, six core competencies. Design and setting. An 8-member multi-center panel consisting of joint pediatric palliative care and pediatric critical care medicine clinicians with expertise in fellow education curricula design used a modified Delphi model to construct subcompetencies for pediatric palliative care within the ACGME core competency domains. These included patient care, medical knowledge, interpersonal and communication skills, professionalism, problem-based learning, and system-based practice. The process for development involved the following steps. 1. Literature search. 2. Evaluation of the ACGME program requirements for pediatric palliative care and pediatric critical care medicine. 3. Consensus meetings and evaluation to generate core knowledge, skills, and experiences needed using rating scales to sequentially prioritize curriculum content. And 4. Selection and approval by multi-center team. Complete agreement was necessary for subcompetency inclusion. Main results. Following the multi-step review process, 20 sub-competencies mapped to the core competency domains were included. A majority of sub-competencies were within the medical knowledge domain. Sub-competencies were further mapped to suggested and trustable professional activities and to specific recommended training years for sub-competency completion. Conclusions. We present the first recommended pediatric palliative care sub-competencies for pediatric critical care medicine fellows. Utilization of sub-competencies for fellow trainees is necessary to build primary palliative skills and improve confidence in delivering palliative care medicine within the pediatric critical care setting. Future efforts are needed to determine best practices for teaching and measuring competence. Recommended sub-competencies have the potential to standardize national pediatric palliative care curricula for pediatric critical care medicine fellowship programs. Abstract 10 is a research letter by Van Twist et al. Beyond Standby, the Impact of Powering Down Devices in Pediatric Intensive Care. The healthcare sector contributes approximately 4.5% of annual global greenhouse gas emissions, with ICUs generating nearly three times the emissions of standard care units. Given the significant environmental impact of ICUs, it is crucial to explore strategies that may reduce the carbon footprint, as ICUs rely heavily on electrical equipment, much of which remains switched on even when not in use. Powering down the ICU may pose a feasible strategy. In 2023, Drinhaus et al. Showed that a standard ICU bed setup, including a ventilator, monitor, and infusion pumps, consumes 114 watts on standby, 161 watts in use, and 22 watts when switched off. These findings suggest that powering down the ICU could reduce electrical consumption, carbon dioxide emissions, and costs. We therefore aim to validate these findings in our neonatal and PICU by measuring the power consumption of standard and additional devices that, while essential, can be switched off for most of the time. Our study was approved with a waiver of consent from our local medical ethics committee on the basis that non-patient data were being used. We used the Voltcraft SEM 5000 energy logger to measure power consumption in each device six times in standby, switched on, and off modes to determine mean with standard deviation power values. We recorded device boot times from power on to readiness for use. Power use and boot times varied, but most devices consume significant power on standby while having short boot times. The heat lamp and incubator even showed increased power consumption during standby versus on mode. Our results confirm that switching devices off is more effective than the standby mode in reducing energy use. A typical PICU setup, monitors, bedside computers, infusion pumps, and a ventilator with humidifier consumed 170 watts on standby, 231 watts in operation, and 100 watts when switched off. These measurements exceed the values reported by Drinhaus et al., which may be due to the difference in devices included in our setup. An incubator with mattress heating and humidifier showed that consumption rose to 341 watts when in use, or 236 watts on standby, or 108 watts when switched off. Powering down devices could save between 0.70 kilowatts without the incubator and 0.128 kilowatts with the incubator, with additional savings of 0.179 kilowatts when non-essential equipment is switched off. Beyond the environmental benefits, this strategy could substantially cut costs. However, some exceptions exist, such as the extracorporeal membrane oxygenation or ECMO device, which must remain on for emergencies. Although boot time was only 20 seconds, priming and calibration take longer, meaning optimization of the number of ECMO devices on standby could improve efficiency. Importantly, safety concerns do not justify the routine use of the standby mode for medical devices. The longest boot time observed was 4 minutes 20 seconds for the ventilator, which is sufficient time for most clinical scenarios. Technically, no major concerns emerge from switching off devices. However, some devices must stay plugged in to ensure an uninterrupted power supply for critical functions and, as such, still consume energy when switched off. Prolonged off mode may reset certain devices, as seen with the Dräger Infinity M540, and some may trigger shutdown alarms, impacting the environment. Manufacturers should improve device design to withstand off mode. Before implementing power down policies, we advise units to assess feasibility and safety within their setting. Although seemingly minor, this energy conservation intervention may promote a culture of energy conscious care, reducing both costs and environmental impact. The PCCM narrative this month is by Dr. Bellini, A Conversation in the Delivery Room. The delivery room felt familiar. The mother was tired from the long labor. The father supported her with whispered words. The midwife encouraged her, telling her that the baby was near. She pushed and the baby's hair was visible. The midwife helped the mother to breathe and push. After this final effort, a new life was finally born. Before cutting the umbilical cord, the midwife placed the newborn on the mother's chest. The mother cried out, "He's wonderful! He's crying a lot! Now I'm sure he's healthy!" The mother held him tightly, then began to cry too. The midwife handed me the newborn wrapped in a light green cloth. No longer crying, he was calm and beautiful. I warmed my hands and placed my thumbs under the soles of his feet, gently grasped his lower limbs, listened to his breathing and heartbeat, and took his pulse. All was well, truly magnificent. I looked at his face, recognizing beautiful features, and tried to catch his gaze, though it was difficult so soon after birth. Then the newborn opened his eyes, widened them, looked at me intensely, and began to speak. "You've been in the delivery room for years, but you're still taken in by the same old nonsense. My mother, to whom you taught antenatal classes, was sure I was healthy because I cried like a siren. You've seen thousands of births. Surely you know how we're made, how we function. You're quite old now, and your memory may be foggy, but do you really remember nothing?" I kept looking into his eyes while he was talking to me, but I couldn't understand where his thoughts were coming from. "Why do you say that? Everyone believes that a newborn strong cry is a sign of excellent health. It's been that way for centuries, and you're right. I've seen many, many children born. Each time, that first cry lifts the tension in the room. It turns anxiety into joy. Why do you want to deny that?" "You have studied a lot," the newborn continued, "so you know the first breath is the most difficult. It's harder than the last, which comes sooner or later. You have to force air into your lungs. It's painful, but we must breathe. We all scream because we're here. The air intoxicates us. That scream is pain and joy. It's how we announce ourselves to the world. Then, breathing becomes less frequent, less painful. Eventually, the breath becomes sweet, delicate. The air no longer hurts. It flows. Life is now established. Come on, I'm sure you have these steps in mind. How many thousands of times have you seen such a joyful miracle? You're telling me that you didn't cry, but if I understand correctly, you cried out in pain. That is not too far from crying," I try to answer him. "You really don't want to understand," the newborn repeated. "Crying has nothing to do with screaming. Explain to me why someone who has been locked in a bag soaked in water in the dark and hearing only a few sounds like his mother's muffled voice should cry when he comes out into the light and fresh air. During that time in there, we can't help but keep our ear pressed to our mother's heart. You know, her heartbeat, which pounds us, and which, during the long days when there is not much to do but grow and gain weight, becomes a steady tum-ta-ta-ta, a 4 out of 4 rhythm that hammers us. Doesn't it remind you of anything? Are you foggy again? Can't you follow? But what did I do wrong to deserve a doctor like you? I'm trying to help you. Imagine Freddie Mercury walking on the stage to sing We Will Rock You. Can you imagine him sobbing?" Then the newborn added, "Can you see it now? Can you feel it? That rhythm is in us from the start." Hell yeah, I finally got it. You're telling me you're a rock star. So in your opinion, this story about crying at birth is complete nonsense? So in your opinion, everyone would be born happy, or rather euphoric? Are we all superstars capable of making a spectacular entrance into our lives? Is that what you mean? It took a while to finally open your eyes. My mother may have cried, but we are talking about happiness, no pain. Even the pain of childbirth, mothers say, is immediately forgotten at the first cry, at the first scream they hear, perhaps accompanied by a guitar solo or a drum roll. We have the 4x4 within us. It is a generous gift from our mother's heart. It makes us dance. It makes us dream. It inspires us. It makes us fall in love, and it could never make us cry. We are all so happy to come into this world, so totally, definitely happy, that we could never, ever cry for no reason. Finally, the newborn closed his eyes and fell asleep, breathing softly. The doctor looked at him and smiled, wondering how something so simple had taken him so long to see. This concludes the abstracts for the August 2025 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.